Welcome again to another episode of WVU Marketing Communications Today. Live from West Virginia University, a syndicated show at the intersection of data-driven decision-making and marketing practices with your host, Cindy Greenglass. Hey, Cindy.
Hey, Paul. Thanks so much and welcome back. Today we're going to be talking about how to declutter your data and create your own narrative stories. So we've all heard about how you can make your life more balanced when you declutter your closets and straighten out your life. But what about your data? Can you really make yourself better understood when you turn your data into a three-act narrative? Well, today we're going to hear from Neil Varde, who will help us unlock the secrets of how to make your visuals more appealing, tell better, more appealing stories with complex data. So welcome, Neil. Neil, I'm thrilled to have him with us today. He is a global product manager for Rockette and a fellow adjunct instructor at WVU. He teaches both in the Integrated Marketing Communications and the Data Marketing Communications programs. At Rockette, he's responsible for several brands of food and pharmaceutical ingredients and is heavily involved in data visualization through sales and pricing management. Neil's a really smart guy. I'm a little intimidated by this gentleman. He's the developer and current instructor of the IMC Global Brand Communications course and data visualization course. He holds a BS from University of Michigan, summa cum laude, an MS and a PhD from University of Illinois, and an MBA with honors from University of Chicago Booth School of Business. So I am a little intimidated by all those degrees after your name there, Neil. And he's a data scientist. So welcome to our program, Neil. I've said all these really interesting things about your background, but the most interesting thing might be, is it true that you have been on Jeopardy not once, but twice? I mean, how cool was that?
Yeah, thanks. Well, first, thanks for having me, Cindy. And yes, it's true. I was on the show twice. So it was a little bit of a stroke of luck. So I was sitting home one night and a buddy of mine had texted me that they were having tryouts for the show, an online test. And I decided I didn't have anything else to do that evening. So took the test and then just didn't hear back for a couple of weeks and then got an email about an in-person audition. So decided to take the day off work, went down to downtown Chicago and tried out in person. So took a test, did a simulated game. And at the end of that, they tell you that, great, you're in the contestant pool. You may or may not be in the contestant pool for 18 months. So, you know, you may hear from us within 18 months. And if you don't, then feel free to try out again. So I had my hopes held up pretty high. And after 3 months, they fell down a little bit, 6 months, 12 months. I didn't hear anything until I got the call. And at first, I actually thought it was my friends playing a prank on me and then quickly realized that it was real. So flew out for the show. And yeah, it's quite an experience. So what they don't tell you when you try out, when you're on the show, is they tape 5 shows a day. So you're out there and you're in the green room with all these other contestants. Everyone's trying to size each other up. It's really intimidating. And because of all these game show scandals of the 1950s, you don't know when you're going to go on. So you have this feeling of anticipation and nervousness until your name is called. And I was in the 4th game that day and was lucky enough to win once and then got demolished the next game by a lawyer and a teacher. But I still have that one victory. So that was really cool.
And then, very cool.
Yeah. And then a few years later, they announced that they were launching Sports Jeopardy, which a lot of people don't know about it. But it's, and to be honest, I don't even know if it's still an active show, but it was on an online channel. And so they were starting that up and so invited previous contestants to try out for that. And same sort of thing, online test, in-person audition, and same thing, got the call to be on the show and lost, but still was a great experience.
Can you recall any of the questions that you aced?
You know, on the regular show, I remember I did well on two categories about Boston Red Sox, because I think the other two contestants didn't know too much about sports. And then on an art category, and I just happened to be a lot of the show ends up being on the timing of the buzzer. So, you know, as you watch at home, what you don't see is that you're not allowed to buzz in until Alex Trebek has finished reading the question. And there's a little light that flashes for the contestants that say it's okay to buzz in. But the counter part of that is that if you wait until you see the light, you're usually too late. So it's an anticipation where you have to time it just as he's done saying the last syllable. That's the time to ring in, and you just have to hope that you're first and don't get locked out.
Ah, so once again, timing in life is everything.
Exactly.
Right? Well, thanks, Neil, for sharing that story with us. Let's dig in here with a little context of your own professionally. Tell us a little bit about how you use data visualization in your role at Roquette, sales and pricing management.
Sure. So a little bit of background about Roquette. We're a French company, and we make ingredients largely to the food and pharmaceutical markets based on raw materials. So we take things like corn, wheat, potatoes, peas, microalgae, and in the food market, we convert them into, we extract the fibers, proteins, sweeteners, sell those into, you know, big CPG companies into food products, you know, anything from protein drinks to baked goods, confection. And on the pharma side, we make the things called excipients. And what excipients are basically anything in tablets except for the active drug. So, you know, based on our ingredients, we can make a tablet so it's swallowable versus chewable versus something that'll dissolve on your tongue. So we have a lot of factories, you know, throughout the world. And my role as global product manager is to ensure the financial health of our different products. And so in terms of data visualization, we use a lot of dashboards. And a few different ways that we use that. First is looking at capacity utilization. So we have all these plants and fixed assets, and we want to keep them running at full steam. So we look at how we best sell out the plant. So based on the visualization dashboards we have, we can decide, okay, well, you know, this plant can make multiple products. Maybe we need to make product B instead of product A. And based on the marketing and sales demand, we can sell more of that and sell out the plant. So that's one aspect. The next aspect in terms of pricing, you know, the laws of supply and demand hold up in the B2B markets just like they hold up in B2C markets. So we look at, you know, as customers take more volume, they expect a better price. So we look at pricing curves. And for a plant and a product that's sold out, we look to see, okay, well, you know, maybe this customer is paying a really good price. You know, we can give them more volume. Or we look and say, well, this customer is taking a large volume, but their price is really low. We need to bring that price up, or we need to find another customer. So that sort of visualization tools on pricing help us decide, okay, you know, what kind of day-to-day operational changes do we need to make to our business?
And is that data visualization being used by the analysts or by the business unit owners or both?
Actually, both. So, you know, we are a matrix organization. So you have people assigned to global roles as well as regional roles. And we have marketing, you know, front-of-the-line sales management, and product managers that are all heavily involved in this data visualization. So we've actually rolled out these tools to pretty much the whole company so they can all have that common ground and speak the same language.
A lingua franca. That's great. So we're talking about decluttering data, right, and the omnipresent graphs and charts that we use in our presentations to declutter data. And I'm thinking when I hear data visualization, you know, I think pie charts, bar charts, and what we're used to. Where do you start to declutter it? It gets a little overwhelming. Let's start there.
Yeah. It does. And I think we need to go back and look at what role data really plays. And one of my favorite quotes about data comes from a book by the Heath brothers, Made to Stick. And the quote is, data are just summaries of thousands of stories. You tell a few of those stories to help make the data meaningful. And I think, you know, with all these technological tools and data visualization tools, really the focus has increasingly become on making a cool visualization, and we lose what the meaning of the data is. The data is not the ends. Data is a tool that you use to tell your story. And so you have that, you know, that onus to make data look cooler and cooler. You have all these infographics, all these cool data visualizations, and the message can be lost. So that's one bad aspect of how we get to clutter in the first place. The second part is, you know, I think all of us, or some of us, tend to treat PowerPoint presentations as real estate in Silicon Valley or Manhattan, meaning that you have this white space and you want to get the most bang for your buck. And so you want to show everything possible because you have, you know, maybe two slides in a presentation. And, you know, so you have the cluttered graphs with all this information. And I think you get invested in your own story and you forget that not everyone has the same background. So you skip over background information. So all that combination together, it's really lethal to an audience. And so, you know, really you need to start to declutter. So where do you start? So, you know, one of the first principles I look at is cognitive load. And there's this Harvard psychologist in the mid-50s, George Miller, that did this study of what you know, how much memory can humans really retain at one point? And he came up with this theory that, you know, really it's 7 bits of information plus or minus 2 depending on the individual. So he came up with this new idea of chunking. So the idea that we can separate information into discrete amounts of data. So you take, for example, your phone number. With the area code, you have 10 digits. But we chunk that into 3 amounts. We have the area code, and then you have the first 3 digits, and then the next 4. And that allows us to remember things more efficiently. And you can apply that same principle on your data visualizations. So the question is, how do you apply that chunking? And the answer is white space. So you go against what the intuition is. So your natural feeling is, I need to show all this data all at one time. This is all important. And you have to take a step back and say, what's really important? And so you focus in on that data that's important. You build in that white space to separate parts of data so that, you know, to the audience, they can naturally chunk that data by looking at that white space. That white space is that key.
That's interesting because we use white space also in graphic design. Mm-hmm. It's so important in for marketers in your messaging. We know white space is your friend, right?
Exactly.
If you have too much cluttered background, you mm-hmm. don't see things. So I never thought of using that in your presentations for graphs and charts. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, I think the older I get, the less I can. I don't know about the plus or minus 2.
Yeah.
I think I'm the minus 2 on the chunking these days. But to go along with that, just exactly what you were saying, I had learned that Google employees mm-hmm. are being trained to present in a bolder, fresher style, mm-hmm. and to use less text and more mm-hmm. visuals. Exactly mm-hmm. what you're saying there. And the CEO of Google was quoted as saying that since stories are best told with pictures, bullet points and text-heavy slides are increasingly being asked to be avoided at Google. How do you feel about that? Can you share pictures without copy? Mm-hmm. I mean, where's the context?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, I think it's not a direct replacement, but there's certainly times where a picture can replace a lot of the data and bullet points. And I think it goes back to this idea of storytelling. You know, even with a huge sum of data, at the end of the day, you have to be a storyteller. And if that picture can help you, you know, tell that premise of that story in a way that picture represents a premise that'll stick in your head, then by all means, use that picture. And then you can build in that context with your words. You know, I think we've all seen slides where it's just so text heavy that your audience tends to read the text and not pay attention to the speaker. And I know, Cindy, you're a big fan of a lot of TED Talks.
Yes,
and
I am.
And I think, you know, the most memorable TED Talks are the ones where, you know, they have slides, but you're so intent on the storyteller that you keep your focus on the storyteller. And then maybe you refer to the slide as sort of a secondary piece of information to, you know, build in, you know, to help complement the actual person and the verbal language.
You know, I'm amazed when I watch TED Talks because I think they're the hardest thing in the world to do. Mm-hmm. I've never done one. You know, it would be nice someday if I was ever to be asked. I'd be flattered, but I think I'd be terrified mm-hmm. because presentations provide a nice crutch for us presenters.
Right.
And one of the things that the people that give TED Talks say is, you know, no bullet points. Mm-hmm. Bullet points are the enemy of the good and the crutch of all presenters. How do you feel about bullet points in presentations?
Yeah, it's kind of a hate-love relationship. So I think bullet points, if you take it to an extreme, they can be bad. Because we've all seen presentations where you have bullet points, then sub-bullets, subheadings, dashes. And you have 4 or 5 layers, and, you know, you go down one layer, and then you go to the next bullet point, and then you lose track of what, you know, what's trying to be conveyed. And, you know, I think if you keep it simple with some bullet points, you can really convey your message. When I was an intern back in, you know, this is after I finished high school, and I'm dating myself to the mid-90s, I got an internship at Ford Motor Company. And for all the high school interns, they had all these presentations lined up with senior executives and other people on what we can do to make our career and our life a success. And honestly, this was before the days of PowerPoint, so we had, you know, these things called transparencies where you would and overhead projectors where you would print out onto plastic and then, you know, shift. And I remember, you know, all these executives would rush through these talks and we didn't remember anything. But the one person that made a great talk was this engineer. And I still remember 20 years later, the bullet points he had.
Oh.
And they were, you know, learn how to learn, treat each other well, and always remember to change your engine oil.
That's great. Well, on that note, we're going to take a quick break and send it back to Paul in the studio. And I thought you were going to say always change your underwear, but we'll chat with you and come back to Neil in a moment.
Well, after you change your underwear, you might want to check out some of these things here, because we've got some amazing ideas and offerings for you. One of is... Well, it really has to do with what we're talking about. Marketing is more than just ads and press releases now. It's about building relationships. It's connecting with other marketing professionals, like at places like West Virginia University's Integrate Conference coming up in Morgantown, West Virginia, August 1st through the 4th. You can network and learn from industry leaders. Speakers represent large and innovative organizations like Cisco and Facebook, as well as big agencies like Cappuccino and Fujikado. Register today at integrate.wvu.edu for West Virginia University. Then after you do that, you want to check out their online data marketing communications program that we highlight here each and every week. It's the first graduate program to focus on data's impact on marketing communications. Learn innovative strategies from award-winning faculty as you shape the future of marketing. You can tune in every week and learn more, or you can jump in and swim with the big guys. Data Marketing Communications Program at dmc.wvu.edu. All right, as we swim through the sea of data, I have to acknowledge that I, too, am a U of M alumni here, but I only graduated magna cum laude. I feel a little intimidated here.
Join me on that one, Paul.
And happy to have a fellow Will Breen on board.
That's right. Summa cum laude. That's an impressive credential here. But I'll let you pick back up here and talk about all the data ways to convey data. These were, you know, I have to ask a question before you guys jump in here. Will we ever get to a point where PowerPoint is extinct and it's something other than a slide? Or will we always have to have some sort of prop in our shows here?
I think there's always going to be a prop. I think you can minimize it to a point, but there's always going to be people that need or want it, for better or worse.
Yeah, I use it as a prop. I know I do. It's really, I think, intimidating when you watch professional speakers. That's why I love those TED Talks. You get up there and you see them just walk on the stage. They have no notes. They have no cue cards. They don't even have the teleprompters, and they just speak so incredibly well.
It's amazing to see, and they make it look so easy, too.
They do. Someday, Paul, maybe we'll get rid of PowerPoint. It'll be replaced by something else. Well, but on that note, so... Nancy Duarte, who arguably is an expert in presentation and in how to present exceptionally well, talks about the power of less is more. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we talk about, you know, don't put everything you know on the single slide. Don't have 3-point type with boatloads of copy. And she says, think of your slides as billboards. Mm-hmm. When people are driving by, they only briefly take their eyes off the main focus, which is the road, and process that billboard of information really quickly. Similarly, our audience, when we're giving a presentation, should focus intently on what we're saying, looking only briefly at the slide when you display it. Otherwise, you're distracting them from yourself. So while that sounds really good to me, this goes back to like the impressive TED Talks, and you can't really share one big statistic on it, or maybe you can, on a graphic and then hope that it's understood without any context.
Yeah.
So if you take the individual's commentary or narrative away from the graphic, how do you combine simplicity with complexity of message?
Yeah, that's a good question, because it seems like a catch-22, but I think there's different ways you can do that. And I'll give an example from a talk that I used to give. So earlier in my career at Roquette, I was giving a lot of presentations on the obesity epidemic in the U.S., and the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, has this really cool map, and I culled together this into an animated form. And basically what it shows is from the mid-90s, it's a map of the U.S., and it colors in each state as to their proportion of the population that were obese. So it had 0 to 5%, 5 to 10, and so on. And what I did is I colored the map so that less than 20% were different shades of blue, and greater than 20% were different shades of orange or red. And so you could see this evolution in the mid-90s where, you know, most everything was blue, different shades of blue, and then, you know, mid-2000s, you started seeing red, darker red, darker red. And there was one state that was still in the blue, Colorado. And so that became the focus of my talk. What was Colorado doing? What was it about that? And so when I was talking, you'd see this animated map, and people would pay attention to this and show the year flashing by. And I kind of wanted them to become overwhelmed by this and look at the map. So the whole point of the map was to show there was this one state that was a little bit different, and I elucidated that by showing that in a different color, that while everything else was changing colors, this was there. And so in that way, you know, as one example, I use the idea of something being overwhelming to show a specific point. And I think you can have strategies like that. So that might not be applicable in all contexts, but, you know, one example, if you're showing a complicated graph, maybe a line graph that has 50 things, you show that initially, and then you just white out everything else or shade that a lighter color and make the piece of data that you're looking for just stand out. So, you know, you can focus in, you can show the context of a larger thing and still have the audience trying to figure it out, but then you hone in on that one piece of data, and then you can use your words to explain that context. It doesn't always have to be built in into the visual.
So that sounds like it takes a lot of work and effort on the part of the person presenting the data. Mm-hmm. You really have to understand it.
Exactly.
To do this. I mean, when you're explaining it to me, I'm thinking of the number of presentations I've sat through where people are basically spewing a lot of data at you and not giving a lot of meaning to it. This sounds like you have to really understand the why in order to be able to strip away all of that static.
Exactly. And it's, you know, if you think about giving a presentation, you know, you can give a presentation for any reason. But if you have a specific call to action, you know, you really need to understand the what's your point and then build everything based on that. And also understand your audience, their buy-in, their level of understanding. It's not so simple to just, it's easy just make a PowerPoint deck. It's not so simple to actually give the presentation built in all that.
Yes, that is for sure. You, in your classes, when you teach at WVU, you talk about the three-act narrative structure to formulate your own data story. Now, I'm a big fan of everything in threes. Mm-hmm. And you know there's some magic, right,
yes,
to the number three. What is the three-act narrative structure?
Yeah, so it's pretty much a narrative structure that you see in a lot of Hollywood films and fiction. And basically it boils down to, as it sounds, it's simple, beginning, middle, and end. So you think about any sort of Hollywood movie that you see. In the beginning, you meet the characters. There's some exposition about who they are, the world they live in. And then at the end of that first act, there's some sort of conflict, some sort of situation that your protagonists face. Then that middle, that second act, they have to overcome that conflict. And you have this rising action of tension while they try and figure out how they do this. The tension builds and builds to this climax. And then in the third act, there's some sort of resolution. That tension gets resolved. They either figure it out or they don't. And you have that falling action, then finally that resolution, and then that end to that narrative. And I look at data storytelling as the same sort of thing. At the end of the day, a data presentation is no different from any other story. You're telling a story. So you have to have that same three-act structure, but you just have it in a different way. So in your first act in a data story, you want to frame a business or a marketing situation for an audience. So you introduce the current situation, and the goal is you want common ground. So remembering that principle of tension, you need to know your audience to understand what their stakes and what their buy-in is. Only then can you really start to craft that story and have a good introduction. So that's the introduction to the data story. Then the middle, you have to discuss the context. So maybe it's a business situation and the conflict that, you know, our sales are declining. Well, then you have to go into the depth of that. You know, how bad is the situation? You know, how bad is it really? Is this going to get worse? And if you tell your story right, at this point, you should have your audience really paying rapt attention because you have the context, you understand what their buy-in is, and you're crafting your story to where they see this is a real problem. And then that third act is really your resolution. So in this case, it's most often a call to action. So first act, you introduce the problem or conflict. Second act, you went into further detail as to why the problem is bad. And now you have some proposals for what you can do to resolve it. So maybe it's investing more resources. It's, you know, having some coupons. You know, you're explaining these proposals and what could work. And then your audience should say, okay, you know, there should be that call to action where your audience makes a decision or has that in their mind that they have to make a decision or this situation is going to get worse.
That's good. You got to make sure that you have a reason before they get up and leave the room.
Exactly.
Right? So don't sit there and say, all right, what do you want to do with all this information I was just given? Give them a decision to make.
Exactly.
Or a call to action. I like that, how we use that direct response call to action. With the couple of minutes that we have left today together, Neil, gosh, we could talk all afternoon about this. You are an adjunct instructor in the WVU program. And tell me, what's the experience been like with you and your students?
Yeah, it's been great. So a little bit about the DMC program. It's a relatively new program at WVU. And what I really see is it's a bridge between data science and front-of-the-line business. So if you look at the data science field, in 2013, you had literally just a handful of schools offering a master's in data science. Flash forward to now, just 5 years later, and you have over 50. And if you include business analytics or regular analytics, now you have about 200 schools offering graduate programs in this. And you know, what I've seen in programs in data science is there's a lot of focus on how you manipulate data to come up with insights. There's not a lot of focus in the storytelling. So where the DMC program really serves a great ground is that bridge between data scientists, the people that come up with insights, and the front-of-the-line business. So knowing how to come up with those insights and present it in a way that you can have that call to action and solve business issues. So I teach brand data visualization, and it's been a great experience so far. My second time teaching the class is going on right now. We have a great cohort of students, and we really see how businesses, you know, from the students' experiences, are evolving to really bring in this digital focus and visualization to help solve their business problems.
Wonderful. Well, Neil, it's been a real pleasure having you on the show this week. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good luck to you.
Thanks.
And your students are very fortunate to have you. So,
thanks, Cindy.
We wish you well. Have a good day.
Great.
You've been listening to another episode of WVU, Marketing Communications Today, from West Virginia University and the Funnel Radio Channel for at-work listeners like you.